B. Collins.
Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Monday, April 24th, 2017. I want to salute the hundreds of thousands of people who marched across the nation Saturday in support of science. And high marks to the protesters who wrote their own clever signs. There are a lot of cool messages out there. On Sunday, in a front page story that bled deep into the news section, the New York Times went deep. It's, one, two, three, four full pages of text with some photographs describing the backstory and the details of James Comey, the FBI director's clear intervention and interference in last year's presidential election cycle. And the story is interesting. It adds a lot of new details, and I've linked to it. I recommend that you read it and read it critically. Because my gripe, once again, is that this is a piece that is based on official unnamed leaks. Lots of them. Now, there are people named in the story. Comey himself, some close associates, people related to Loretta Lynch, the final Obama attorney general. But the piece is written like a novelist in the omniscient voice. We don't know whose voice it is, but that voice knows everything that went on, was in every meeting. And, of course, that is not pure journalism. Much of this information is detailed but unsourced. And when they flatly state as fact, this is my consistent gripe. Maybe you've picked it up if you're a regular listener. They consistently play the issue, the allegation, that Russia was directly responsible for hacking the DNC servers, giving that information to WikiLeaks for distribution. This remains completely unproven based on public information, and the Times continues to make that the foundation of this sandcastle. And I have, obviously, some serious problems with that. But what we learn is that, and what is useful about this is that it is based on a timeline. And in many investigative stories, one of the most effective tools you can use is just to chart everything out and see the sequence of events as they unfolded or unraveled. And so the central piece here is comparing the way James Comey dealt with the investigation into Hillary Clinton's email server and related matters, and the way he dealt with the very separate investigation into associates of Donald Trump and their contacts with Russia, perhaps leading to efforts to manipulate the election using Trump advisors. Now, I think these are both very significant stories, and I believe that we deserve deep investigations. We also deserve transparency, and we did not receive that from too tall Jim Comey. And Comey's mostly unnamed associates make the case that he was above the partisanship, above the fray, and determined not to be political. Just the straight-o potato investigator, right? Well, it details how, starting in July 2015, when the Benghazi investigation of the Congress disclosed the email server at the Clintons' home, that led to a letter from the Inspector General for the intelligence community alerting the FBI that classified information had been found on Hillary Clinton's server. Now, this was not disclosed to us before. This appears to be the original trigger for the investigation. And so the article goes on to say that the Justice Department, which, as you may know, is nominally the at the top of the organizational chart, and the FBI director technically reports to the Attorney General. But as we see, this was a relationship that was rife with distrust, as Loretta Lynch was apparently running interference for her friends, the Clintons. So this was a very delicate, obviously highly charged political issue, We know that as that investigation into Hillary's server went forward, the hack of the DNC computers began in the fall of 2015, and an FBI agent talked to a low-level young employee at the DNC, actually leaving messages for this person, and the person didn't believe that it was really an FBI agent who was saying you ought to check your server. And so months went by, and nobody did diddly about the hack of the DNC computers in the fall of 2015. So as this moves forward, we head into the election season last year, and we had the case of David Petraeus. And there apparently was a dispute between the FBI and the Justice Department. Comey and his agents wanted to press charges and did not want to do the plea agreement that David Petraeus was permitted to agree to. And so that was part of the backstory here that established a kind of standard. And they felt that they had to have a bigger crime, more intent of Hillary's to break the law before they could bring charges against her. So then a suspicious document surfaced, and this is the so-called dossier that came from Christopher Steele, the British intelligence agent who was working first for a Republican campaign and then later for I still don't know which Democratic entity was paying him. But this led to the FBI digging in deeper into questions of the Trump campaign. But those really didn't surface until they had already cleared Hillary on July 6th when Comey went public. And there was a dispute about that because just a few days before, the Attorney General, Loretta Lynch, had that bizarre meeting with Bill Clinton, who climbed onto her airplane as it was parked on a taxiway at the Phoenix Sky Harbor International Airport. And we know about that exchange and that it was highly inappropriate. They describe how at the moment that Bill Clinton hopped on her plane, there were people who called the Justice Department and said, hey, look, this is not good optics. And staff members noticed that. They called the communications director, who told them to break up the meeting immediately. The Times reports a staff member rushed to stop it, but by the time the conversation ended, Clinton had been on the plane for about 20 minutes. So on July 6, after the 3.5-hour weekend interview between FBI agents and Hillary Clinton, for which there was no transcript, and we believe she was not testifying or answering questions under oath, that's when Comey interfered in the election for the first time. And he issued that shaming statement where he said that Hillary had been careless. And yes, there were classified materials on her server, but that he does not recommend charges. And then, in a new subhead, the Times says, days after Comey's news conference, Carter Page, an American businessman, gave a speech in Moscow criticizing American foreign policy. Page had been previously under FBI scrutiny, was believed to have been marked for recruitment by Russian spies, now a foreign policy advisor named by Trump. And then Page said that he has not said whom he met during his July visit, describing them as mostly scholars. But then he went to Moscow again, raising new concerns among counterintelligence agents. So we know that James Comey knew by mid-July that there were questions about contacts between Trump advisors and Russian individuals who they apparently knew about. And yet Comey did not share with the American public the information that both presidential candidates on the November ballot were under FBI investigation. And I regard this as a very critical breach of fairness and transparency on the part of Comey. Now, he claims that the extraordinary event was that he spoke up and said that Hillary Clinton would not be charged. That was the exceptional moment, according to James Comey. But to claim that you're just going to conduct the Trump investigation under normal secret protocols after you've dished this dirt on the opponent? Well, I think that that is highly inflammatory, totally unfair, And the FBI director has never even acknowledged that, much less apologized for it or acknowledged the outsized role that he may have played. So then we have late July, the surfacing of Christopher Steele's intelligence dossier. But it appears the FBI didn't dive right into it. They took months to try to figure out what may have been provable in the Steele documents, these opposition research reports to political campaigns. But they were not on a fast track to explore that, hopefully coming to some resolution before the November election. Then we have the CIA director briefing Harry Reid. John Brennan talked to him in late August and revealed quite a bit about this. It led Harry Reid to publish some letters that appeared odd at the time, saying that, it has become clear you possess explosive information about close ties and coordination between Trump and the Russian government. And, of course, Comey said nothing. So this is, some solid reporting. I've identified my concerns about the use of more anonymous, officially high-placed sources and this omniscient voice that carries the narrative of the story. But it does identify the real unfair playing field that was created by Comey and that did certainly hurt Hillary Clinton's prospects, especially, as you know, with the October follow-up letter because of Anthony Weiner's computer, and then the letter just a few days later saying, never mind. These are really inappropriate actions on the part of the FBI director. And as you know, I was not a supporter of Hillary Clinton for president. But this kind of interference by a top law enforcement official who should have remained neutral as much as humanly possible shows that we did not have a fair election last November. And was it a fair election in France over the weekend? Well, it wasn't Jim Comey who interfered or meddled in the French election. It was Donald Trump with his tweets and other comments that were clearly supporting Marine Le Pen. Now, from here, I can't evaluate if Trump's interference or meddling had any actual impact. But in a race with four contenders who got close to 20% of the vote, the centrist banker and technocrat who surfaced with a new political party in the last 12 months, Emmanuel Macron, he placed first with, 23.9%, so call it 24%. Marine Le Pen, the aggressive nationalist and right-winger, got 21.5%. So it was very close, and they will run off in just a couple of weeks on May 7th. And most Americans don't know diddly about Emmanuel Macron, but he is a banker who served as an economist in the administration of the current president, François Hollande. Knowing that the Socialist Party was a liability or a drag on a potential candidacy, Macron formed his own new party, and I'll get you the name of that. I've got it in this next article here. But the two of them do offer voters a distinct choice, and Macron is seen as a pro-Europe establishment figure, but as part of his campaign, he conducted some massive polling. Some 25,000 French people were given detailed polling questionnaires, and so his platform is a hodgepodge. He claims that he wants to roll back some regulations and end the 35-hour work week, and at the same time, he plans to protect the social safety net, the socialist economic structure in France. He is perceived as the money candidate, and also the candidate of the European Union. And it remains to be seen if the virus of Brexit has crossed the English Channel and how much the European community and related issues will be a focus of the runoff campaign and voter behavior. And I, for one, can't predict that because just based on my anecdotal contact with a handful of French nationals, there are very mixed feelings about Brussels and the European Union in France, just as there were in Britain. So this is going to be very interesting. Macron's new party is called En Marche, On the Move. And the interesting factoid about him is that as a high school student, he fell in love with his drama coach, who is 24, 25 years his senior. And he decided at the time he was going to marry her, and he persuaded her to divorce her husband and bring her three children along and marry him. That's the only, People magazine detail that I know about this guy. But he certainly has cut a figure, and as we see, the French people have to narrow their choice to one of these two. The predictions are that Marine Le Pen does not have a chance of winning. And based on what we saw here in the United States, I think those are dangerous predictions to make. But our buddy Juan Cole at the University of Michigan is willing to say it. While she is highly unlikely to win the runoff presidential election May 7 against the Bill Clinton of France, Marine Le Pen managed to come in second in the first round. She came in ahead of the leaders of both major French political parties. It is a sad day for France and for the world that such a hateful person, a neo-fascist, is running to be the next president. And Juan Cole notes that Le Pen's platform includes denying French Jews the right to hold dual French and Israeli citizenship, and that she recently denied French responsibility in the roundup of Jews in the 1940s. So it is a very clear kind of stark choice for the people of France, and I, for one, will be watching it very closely. Meanwhile, here in the United States, we may be headed for a potential government shutdown at the end of this week. And it would be bizarre, because the Republicans control both houses of Congress, and they've got 45 in the White House, right? So it would be factionalism among Republicans and the failure of Democrats to come to the rescue of, say, Majority Leader Mitch McConnell in the Senate to produce a government shutdown under these circumstances. But you've got Trump demanding that Congress, in exchange for agreeing to an extension of the national debt level and the continuity of government operations, the Trump administration wants a down payment on his wall on the southern border of at least a couple of billion dollars, and they've moved into contortions and extortions, as I would say, because they are now dangling the opportunity for Democrats to get continued subsidies for millions of people getting Obamacare in exchange for agreeing to initial funding for the wall. And, of course, this is premised on Trump's bizarre promise that Mexico will eventually pay for it. He never said eventually on the campaign trail, but that's the word he has inserted into his pledge. And I think the Democrats can stand up to this and just say no. But, of course, the Democratic Party is not always unified. This remains to be seen. Now, Trump is compounding this by rushing the announcement that he is going to present his tax cut for the rich plan and corporations on Wednesday. They've already said that there will be a 15% corporate tax, down from 34%, and they're not even going to bother to try to justify the increase in the federal debt that this will cause. They're not trying to propose offsets. They're just saying, we're going to cut taxes, and it's going to be beautiful. And even Mitch McConnell, the Republican Senate leader with a PhD in obstruction, he's a little bit queasy about what might happen. He has acknowledged previously that the Republicans own the government shutdown brand, and, quote, it's not a good brand. Be prepared for the next surge of American forces into Afghanistan. Obama did it twice, and Trump is learning absolutely nothing from it. Mad Dog Mattis, the defense secretary, made a secret trip to Kabul today after a bloody event on Friday where a group of Taliban militants dressed as Afghan soldiers and pretending to be transporting wounded comrades entered a base in Mazar-i-Sharif and opened fire on unarmed soldiers. The carnage continued for hours. More than 100 people were killed in the attack. One figure is as high as 140. And once again, our impulsive, reactive, problem president is probably going to take the bait and send more American troops to the graveyard of empires. Meanwhile, violence is surging south of our border, And this is a reemergence of the really brutal drug cartel violence that peaked back in 2011. And over the weekend, at least 35 people were killed. And here's a stunning figure. In the month of March alone, 2,020 people were murdered in Mexico. Most of this related to the drug cartels. And last night, I watched a documentary that we got at the library on a DVD, that old kind of technology, called Cartel Land. And it was released 2 years ago in 2015. And when I started watching it, the credits said that Catherine Bigelow was one of the executive producers. So I was pretty wary. I thought, oh, God, here's more, you know, CIA propaganda, just like Zero Dark Thirty. But the director, Matthew Heineman, managed to produce a really interesting piece. It looks at vigilante groups on both sides of the border, in Arizona and in the coastal state in Mexico called Michoacán. And going back to about 2013, in Michoacán, a group of just average citizens, led by a medical doctor who had seen too many people die and, you know, be beheaded, brutal behavior by these drug cartels, who were able to keep the federales, the state police, at bay, perhaps through payoffs. And so these people took the law into their own hands. They started to clean up town by town, evicting the bad guys, turning them over to the police. And when the police kept releasing those people, they changed their tactics and started to kill them. And as the movie depicts, it shows how they descended into the same kind of brutal and outlaw behavior as the drug cartels that they had united to defeat. It's really tragic. And on the north side of the border, the filmmakers embedded with some of these militia members, and it's not quite as dramatic, but it does tell their side of the story. Just across San Francisco Bay from me, the officials at the University of California, Berkeley, continue to wrangle with Ann Coulter. And I coined the term blonde bloviator, and I looked it up. Apparently, bloviator isn't quite a word, but I don't care because that's a nice new little tag for her. Anyway, the security officials at the university said that they canceled her speech, which was supposed to be this Thursday night, because they had very specific intelligence that Ann Coulter might be in grave danger. Now, we can't evaluate these kinds of alarming statements because they come, like so much out of Washington today, with no evidence or sourcing. Nobody's telling us what that specific intelligence actually was. But I continue to come down here on an absolutist side of First Amendment rights. And the university changed up its offer. They said, well, Ann, if you're going to come anyway, we're going to offer you a daytime event during dead week when all the students are off campus studying for exams. And you can come and talk to whoever shows up. And I think that's a pretty insulting substitute. And I don't blame Ann Coulter, who just, you know, is a pretty disgusting figure to me. But I don't blame her for reacting the way she has. And here's one of the organizers of By Any Means Necessary, a group that took part in previous demonstrations against Milo Yiannopoulos. They said, "We will not tolerate anti-immigrant bigotry or bigotry of any kind, which is the only thing she's here to do. And I don't tolerate their intolerance. I think that's really stupid and counterproductive. And for them to become judge and jury of Ann Coulter's intentions and her deep-seated bigotry, I think is a mistake, and I think it just flies in the face of the First Amendment." And one of the Republican organizers of the recent protest in Berkeley that was intended to inflame locals and draw violence, his name is Johnny Benitez from Orange County down near Los Angeles, and he admitted that the people he's organizing are coming from 6 hours away. So this is not a matter of local people taking on local people. Simply, UC Berkeley and the city of Berkeley have become venues for targeted provocations. And we must stand firm with the First Amendment, in my view. There's a little bit of daylight between top members of the Trump administration, including 45 himself. Over the weekend, Trump said that any dreamers, these are people who live in the United States, who came here as children, are not citizens. Well, John Kelly, who's the director of Homeland Security, is siding with the president. And the president has said that you don't have to worry about it. Dreamers should rest easy, not fear deportation. His administration is not after the dreamers. We are after the criminals. Of course, the facts belie that. We have a handful of cases of attempts to deport dreamers, and one that has actually occurred. That's Juan Manuel Montes, whose case is going to come before the judge that Trump attacked, whose name is Curiel. We also have Jeff Sessions, the attorney general. That's Jeffrey Beauregard, Jim Crow Sessions, said he's not willing to agree the dreamers could rest easy. Well, we'll see, he said on ABC. I believe that everyone who enters the country unlawfully is subject to being deported. We don't have the ability to round up everybody, and there's no plans to do that, but he is explicitly not singling out dreamers for protection from deportation. A couple of good articles about the spy state over at The Intercept today. Ryan Gallagher reports on NSA blimps. These are helium balloons that are they're like double-hulled tankers. They have a bulletproof vest around the helium balloon that keeps the craft in the air. And some of these, called the Hover Hammer, are equipped with eavesdropping devices called dirt boxes. And these scoop up all the communications within a certain radius of the dirt box. And when you put it up in the sky, the radius is pretty big. And we're told, don't worry, they're not intercepting the communications of Americans, but these blimps are over U.S. airspace, including within coverage of the entire state of New York. So I think this is an important disclosure and alarming, as usual, when we learn more about the surveillance state here. And in a separate article at The Intercept, they take a look at the role that the nation of Japan has played in the expansion of our international surveillance capabilities. And some of these may adversely impact Americans, but what we're seeing is that the Japanese have invested their own money in upgrading American facilities on Honshu and over on Okinawa. And I find this very interesting. I've linked to both of these stories, and I encourage you to read them. They're in the show file at peterbcollins.com. And every day I like to pause for a second and thank the people who support my work with your subscriptions to the Peter B. Collins podcast. People like Tim McKay, Joey Perillo, Wendy Gebauer, and I want to thank Faith Peoples. Over the weekend, she canceled the three subscriptions that she already had to take out one for even more net contributions to the Peter B. Collins podcast. Faith, you're really special, and I thank you for your support. You want to be like Faith? Come on over and take out a subscription. Go to peterbcollins.com. You click on the menu button, pull it down, click on Become a Subscriber, and in minutes, you can make a choice and help support this podcast. Finally today, a couple of items about the Democratic Party. In an op-ed at The Guardian, Cornel West really nails it. As the first 100 days of the plutocratic and militaristic Trump administration draw to a close, one truth has been crystal clear. The Democratic Party lacks the vision, discipline, and leadership to guide progressives in these turbulent times. The neoliberal vision of the Democratic Party has run its course. The corporate wing has made it clear that the populist wing has little power or place in its future. The discipline of the party is strong on self-preservation and weak on embracing new voices. And party leaders too often revel in self-righteousness and self-pity rather than self-criticism and self-enhancement. One more bite here. The 2016 election, which Democrats lost more than Republicans won, was the straw that broke the camel's back. The unfair treatment of Bernie Sanders was but the peak of the iceberg. In the face of a cardboard Republican candidate equipped with pseudo-populist rhetoric and ugly xenophobic plans, the Democratic Party put forward a Wall Street-connected and openly militaristic candidate with little charisma. Yes, friends, it was Hillary or bust. They risked everything on a bad candidate, and at this point last year, at the end of April, It was clear that Bernie Sanders had room to grow and that Hillary did not, that she was being dragged down by scandals and problems of her own creation, the emails, the foundation. And yet they bet everything because they didn't believe that it was any way possible that Trump could win. And finally today, Barack Obama, the former president, get used to that, has reemerged at the University of Chicago, where he sat with six people in conversation in front of an audience. And he's urging people to get involved in politics. Going back to the place where he worked as a community organizer, he said, "The single most important thing I can do is to help in any way I can to prepare the next generation of leadership to take up the baton and to take their own crack at changing the world." Well, I hope the president will inspire a new generation of political activists and leaders. And I just hope he will also tell them, don't be like me and sell out to corporate interests. Thanks for listening to my daily news and comment podcast. It's available free and on YouTube.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.